Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the contributors to strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, your host. We'll be talking to Jim Dunnigan, well-known military analyst, author, and editor of strategypage.com, and Austin Bay, author, columnist, and blogger. His blog can be found at austinbay.net. Welcome, Austin and Jim. Korea has become a hot topic again. It seems like it's just on sort of a cycle. I visited Korea about 10 years ago. One of the things I found interesting about the country was we took a tour of all the palaces in Seoul. And everyone we visited, they would say, well, the original one was built in 13-something, and then it burned down in 15-something, and then we rebuilt it, and then the Chinese came in and burned it down, and we rebuilt it, and then the Japanese came in and burnt it down. They always rebuild. They're a very resilient culture, but now with the split between North Korea and South Korea that's been there for 35 years, Korea continues to be an issue on the international front. What are the current problems, Austin?
Well, wait a minute. 35 years. You're really, from since 1945, you're looking at...
Yeah, I guess I'm sorry.
65 years.
My math was wrong, so what are we...
No, that's all right. That's all right. The point about the split, understand, too, that parts of Korea have been divided from other parts of Korea in terms of spheres of influence in the past with the Chinese and the like, but that's so far back. That's what you're talking about really is moving from the 19th century on. Look, at this point, it's clear that the Korean War is not over, and yet it's over. What do I mean by that? South Korea has won economically, politically. Look, the Secretary General of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, is a South Korean. If you don't think that isn't in the face of Kim Jong-il every day, to see a South Korean leader on the international stage recognized as a major player in every crisis on the planet, obviously it is. And that's just one more bone on the pile, on North Korea's pile. China, who had for years used North Korea as kind of a little bulldog to snap at the United States and Japan and South Korea. That's still the capacity there, but two of China's major trading partners are South Korea and Japan, and they're the ones that North Korea threatens with the extortion racket. First of all, with the ground attack on South Korea, and missile attack, and then missile attack on Japan. And if you think this global recession's bad, imagine a nuke going off over Seoul or Tokyo. They are just absolutely deeply wired into the global economic system. Those two cities, those two highly productive countries. And then China's other major trading partner, the United States, is part of that six-nation process that the United States instigated. That's Japan, South Korea, North Korea, Russia, China, and the U.S. That's designed to, from the Chinese and South Koreans' perspective, and it is extremely valid, to keep North Korea from imploding, because the South Koreans don't want to pay all the costs at once for picking up the destruction of communism in North Korea. The Chinese don't want more refugees spilling into China from North Korea, and the same problem. And Jim writes about that all the time from the Chinese perspective. And we don't want it to explode. The Japanese and South Koreans don't want it. Russia's kind of a silent player in this, but Russia doesn't need any trouble in Eastern Asia. So the United States has been trying diplomatically, and it's slow and it's excruciating, to navigate, keep it from imploding and exploding. Now, and also squeeze the nuke out of it in some shape, form, or fashion. What do the North Koreans want? I'm going to let Jim speak to that here in a second. We both pretty much agree that the North Korean regime wants to survive in some manner, which gives them an ounce of sanity. And yet, look what they're doing. Starting in December, they were supposed to sign a protocol, a nuclear Well, it was a protocol about nuclear inspection that they had agreed to. Well, they decided not to sign it. Hold out and let's see what the Obama administration was going to do. And in part and parcel of their standard dangerous tantrum, there's the threat of a missile launch. What's changed this time is first the Japanese saying outright, we will intercept, and this, the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Forces were the first ones that I can tell to make this statement, lower level in the defense ministry. And this is the way the statement was made actually several weeks ago. If this North Korean launch threatens, parts of it threaten to land on Japanese territory, including territorial waters, we have been given our guidance, our political guidance, that we are authorized to intercept it using their standard three anti-ballistic missiles fired from their Aegis-class destroyers. Now, that was an interesting addition to the gamesmanship. Japan stepping out saying, we're going to stop you. We believe the satellite claim on North Korea is an utter hoax. You know, satellites fall into a different legal bin when they're being launched. But whatever, we're going to defend our territory with this ABM. And then the Japanese restated it weeks later. Maritime Self-Defense Force again, but sort of moving up the chain within the defense ministry. Today, I noticed reports that yesterday, and I believe also this morning, the morning that we record this, a spokesman, senior officers in the U.S. Department of Defense saying that we are capable of intercepting a North Korean launch. In other words, the United States is now picking up on what Japan said. And then definitely yesterday, the Japan Defense Ministry said that they were going to move some of their Patriot PAC-3s, shorter-range anti-ballistic missile or anti-missile missiles, from around Tokyo, where they have the PAC-3s, up to the north where they think that this launch, the launch track will take it. So in other words, the Japanese are putting up the two elements of a layered system, saying that they'll intercept with standard threes, the Aegis missiles from the destroyers, and also have Patriot PAC-3, which are shorter range. In other words, the Japanese are saying, if you guys are going to go ahead and shoot, you shoot, and we're going to demonstrate that we have the ability to defend ourselves against this extortion that you claim that you could shoot at us and then fire a nuke at us. And that changes the political dimensions. In other words, North Korea now, its brinksmanship game is being called. And after that long intro, which I think covered some of your question, Dan, and got to the nubs of the nuclear test, I'll just pass it on to Jim, who knows a heck of a lot about the China and North Korea's relationship.
Well, and reminded me that it's been 59 years since we started our involvement in Korea. Yeah. So it's a lot longer than 30.
1950, but then yep. It was already split after World War II. That's why I say, you know, we're in the sixth decade of it. Okay.
Right.
All right.
Jim, what's the relationship with Korea and China at this point?
North Korea is like somebody's crazy uncle who has a gun collection. In fact, we had a guy, actually there was more than one, when I was a kid growing in upstate New York. Crazy guy, he's old, lots of guns, reputation for being kind of nasty. And if he asked you for something, you give it to him. It wasn't like he was robbing you, but if you had a garden, which a lot of people did, and he'd come down, he'd sort of look at it, said, hey, you know, would you like some tomatoes, some corn? And he'd sort of nod, and you'd give it to him and hope he went away and stayed away. Eventually died, you know, and a couple of kids went up there and found the body. But North Korea has some form of nuclear weapons, and they basically are not just the crazy old guy in the woods. I mean, they're a nation which has basically broken laws. They allowed 2 million of their own people to die from starvation in the 1990s. They have several hundred thousand in prison camps, which are basically slave labor camps. More and more people are getting out of those camps, or getting out of North Korea in general, and coming out with some pretty hair-raising stories of what is now generally considered crimes against humanity. But North Korea has presented itself as such a fearsome, crazy old uncle, that the UN, even though the UN is basically run by a South Korean, well, maybe because the UN is run by a South Korean, nobody wants to go after, you know, Kim Jong-il and the rest of his merry maniacs, you know, up north. They are basically rats in a trap. there's no way they can really save themselves. The economy's a mess. The Chinese keep telling them, look, do what we did. You know, we're commies like you. We're still running a police state. You got to unleash the economy. The reason the North Koreans don't do it, and this is what North Koreans escaping say, is that the government, which has been far more brutal than the Chinese government ever was. And the Chinese government, you got to remember, they killed tens of millions of Chinese, but they did it in a kinder, gentler way. The North Korean government has been brutal, extremely brutal. I mean, they out-Stalin Stalin as far as clamping down and running, you know, probably the worst police state in history. The North Korean communists are afraid if they lighten up, people will want revenge. And Koreans can be very vengeful. I mean, it's just I was over there when I was in the army for a year, so naturally I'm an expert. But I did notice we had one nice thing about the way the American army is run in Korea and has been for over 50 years is early on in the Korean War we were short on people, so we got the idea, well, why don't we just put some Korean soldiers in American units to help out, just extra manpower, or bodies, as they like to say in the Army. And they still do that, except after the war, they insisted that these South Korean GIs spoke English. And now, of course, it's a privileged job. Everybody has to do their 2 or 3 years in the Army. And it's much better duty if you're assigned as what they call a KATUSA, Korean Augmentation, to the U.S. Army, because you're serving in an American unit where the food is better, the quarters are better, the treatment is better. I mean, the first thing I saw when I was in Korea was a bunch of South Korean troops lined up, and the sergeant was chewing them out for something, and they went up to one guy and slugged him and knocked him right down. And then the soldier got up, and he apologized to the sergeant, and the sergeant hit him again. So I said, gee, I'm glad I'm an American. But it's much worse up in North Korea, and the North Koreans basically have this attitude that there's no way out. You know, they're paralyzed. South Koreans, and I do business with a number of South Koreans, and they have connections, business connections up in North Korea, so there's you know, over the last 10 years especially, there have been more and more South Koreans going in and out, as well as North Koreans escaping. And they tell me, you know, it's just insane. You know, nobody knows who's in charge anymore, because there's this constant, you know, contradictory messages coming down. The corruption is increasing. The secret police are becoming both more vicious and more corruptible at the same time, which is a scary, you know, way to go, because these are the people who have literally the power of life and death over anyone. You know, there's just this fear and uncertainty about what's going to happen next. And, of course, now they have nuclear weapons. Of course, they really don't have nuclear weapons. That's something that gets lost in a lot of the reporting. If you go into the details of the reporting, or what we detailed in Strategy Page, they have a nuclear weapon that sort of worked. It's what they call a fizzle. It sort of half went off. So it's not really a bomb that they can deliver anywhere unless they can, you know, manage to get a big tractor trailer, you know, into the target area, which is unlikely. And it'll explode, and it'll spread nuclear radioactive material. It'll be a low-level nuclear explosion. They have a long way to go before they can put a nuclear warhead on a missile and, you know, send it over and nuke Tokyo or whatever, or Seoul. But what they do have is a large conventional force, which is becoming increasingly unreliable. They are starting to have unrest in the North Korean army because the troops aren't getting well-fed anymore. The North Korean government is doing this insane thing of telling the world that we don't need your food aid anymore when the people are starving. And, of course, what's happening is the food rations that the government used to pass out is not being passed out anymore. And there are some areas where there's starvation. They're apparently using food as a weapon. An area that is not behaving as the central government believes it should, all of a sudden no more food trucks arrive. And everybody's afraid the place is just going to blow up. So, you know, there's nothing good you can say about North Korea. It's all bad, and nobody knows where it's going.
And there's nobody to take over for the people if you even push them out of power, correct?
Well, nobody's sure who would take over. There's been a lot of speculation recently about which of the Kim Jong-il, who was ill, so to speak, literally and figuratively, would take over. The younger son, the older son, Apparently, the younger son has got the head on his shoulders, but he's the youngest. He's in his 20s. The guy who's really running the country is Kim Jong-il's brother-in-law. Unfortunately, he's an old-school communist, and he's basically the one who's behind a lot of the crackdowns, because the massive corruption, they have groups of trustworthy, fairly trustworthy secret police to go around and try and crack down. The most recent crackdown was after Kim Jong-il and visited some cities and did the usual dog and pony show. A lot of the officials who saw that were there, you know, to meet and greet him, then began telling all their friends and kinfolk, you know, how bad he looked. Because the guy had a stroke last year, you know, he's not well. And the secret police had recently been sicked onto all these officials who have now been arrested, locked up, and that's probably the end of their careers. But nobody knows who would take over. There are several factions up there. There's a military faction, there's a hardline faction in the secret police, but there's also a progressive faction, or pro-China faction, as they call it. There were rumors last year that the pro-China people, basically people who had connections in China and had been listening to the Chinese saying, for God's sake, reform like we did, you know, let the economy grow and it'll at least give you a chance to survive, literally. They were planning a coup. Now, you don't hear about that anymore. But it's so hard to get information out because people are afraid. The guys who were recently arrested, the town officials, apparently shot their mouths off to the wrong people. You know, they tell them, you know, when the great leader comes in, if he does whatever, however he looks, you don't tell anybody. He looks great. He always looks great. And these guys, you know, maybe they only told a few people, but, you know, there are spies everywhere, literally. Like I say, it's Joe Stalin would be proud of his protégés, because he's the one who set up the dictatorship in the first place. Unfortunately, it's the fear that paralyzes the government into not doing anything, because they're afraid if things get better and people basically get radios and television sets, which a lot of them are getting one way or another, because there is sort of a market economy, the first thing they'll do is want revenge. What happened in Eastern Europe in 1989, especially in Romania, where there was a very bloody, you know, disposal right. of the old Ceausescu and his clan, especially that Dragon Lady wife of his, that scared them big time. And that's why the security got worse after 1980s, throughout the 90s, because they said, my God, when's it going to happen to us? And they're still waiting for the other shoe to drop. So they can't improve the economy. And, of course, it's slowly sliding into the abyss. So they can't really do anything to save themselves either. And, of course, it terrifies the South Koreans because they look what happened in Germany, where poverty-stricken communist East Germany reunited with, you know, very prosperous, you know, Western Germany. It cost them $1 trillion in Germany. And right. from what I'm hearing out of South Korea, they did the math, and it's even worse with North Korea.
Well, it has to be. I mean,
$1 trillion. Yeah. Yes. And what they're really worried about is because they have over 1,000 of these escapees living in South Korea, is that the PTSD, the post-traumatic stress, injuries to Koreans, to North Koreans, is apparently much worse than what was experienced to the East Germans. Because a lot of East Germans, you know, after 40 years of living in the communist year, you forget how to do things for yourself. You're always waiting for orders. And you could see it, the younger generation, the teenagers, they quickly saw, hey, rock and roll, baby, you know, let's all become investment bankers and get rich. Whereas their parents just didn't know what to do. And it's even worse with the North Koreans. So basically there's no good end game for all this. There's nothing but bad news. In fact, the news is so bad that most of the media, both in South Korea and in the West, don't like to report it. You think, you know, that the media thrives on bad news. Well, up to a point. And North Korea is that point beyond the line where people just don't want to, they just turn away. It's horrible.
Well, let me pick up on something that Jim said about the South Korea. It's the South Koreans saw this problem when they watched West Germany absorbing East Germany. And it took about roughly 15 years. I mean, that's give or take. There's some interesting economic speculation about what that point was where West Germany finally absorbed the problems it inherited from the communist East Germany. In other words, the absorbed the poverty, brought the infrastructure up, and there's still social adaptation issues among an entire generation of East Germans, a generation and a half that didn't know how to work like the West Germans, and that's still an ongoing problem. But the compensation that West Germany had to pay, and the compensation for the 50 years, 45 years of communist destruction of the German economy was extraordinary. And South Korean said, North Korea is worse. I might offer two other places in the same category as North Korea. Jim said North Korea is the worst. Tough to argue with it. Just remember Enver Hadja's Albania, Jim. That was that was one of the pits. And remember, it was communist China's ally in Europe as well. And another candidate is Ceausescu's, for craziness, Ceausescu's Romania. But certainly North Korea's taken it to the self-starvation and self-immolation, and which is one of the dangers here. And that implosion, the self-destruction, is what the South Koreans don't want to pay for. They don't want to pay for it in the way that Germany did, because it's going to be more expensive, because North Korea really has nothing. And this is the generation of what becomes a South Korean so-called sunshine policy, which you will hear ultra-hardliners in the United States and still in South Korea and the like say, no, you're propping up the North Koreans. But the intellectual component behind the sunshine policy is that, wait a minute, at some point, these guys are going to collapse. We don't want a war. We don't want Seoul destroyed. And then what are we going to do? They're going to need expressways. They're going to need electrical infrastructure. They're going to need railroads. So in
basic,
some ways,
basic health care.
That's right. Let's start bits and pieces of that now. And that, to me, that makes a lot of sense, how you control it. Plus, it also, as Jim was talking about, you know, the North Koreans, this is a threat. This kind of, even this beginning wealth, is a threat to the way the regime controls the population. And yet, at the same time, they recognize, they see what China has done by opening up the economy. That's what it, I'm not sure the pronunciation, I think it's Kaesong, K-A-E-S-O-N-G, the so-called entrepreneurial area in the north. It employs between 30 and 40,000 North Koreans, and it's owned and run by South Korean companies and has South Korean managers and technical advisors.
Yeah, well, North Korea also exports workers to Russia.
Well, that's true.
Contract workers.
This is something that the North Koreans see some benefit out of, and the South Korean idea is we're going to end up paying for these guys anyway. How do we do it? And that's why I say that this is really one of the most difficult diplomatic endeavors. And
yeah, but see, the big problem is the North Korean government, the Communist Party that runs the country, they are in mortal fear of the retribution. They understand what they have done. I mean, there are true believers who believe that Marx, you know, is still the way of the future. But a lot of them, they're not stupid people. And they understand we will die. You know, war crimes, you know, they remember what happens to the Ceausescus, you know, the people came in, the guys, their own secret police came in with machine guns and then just machine gunned them up against the wall, blah, blah, blah.
Elena and Nikolai died for their sins very rapidly.
And they died in a very ugly way, and it was fun, and it was filmed. And from what I'm hearing, you know, from my Korean associates is that, you know, that the specter, the pall of that video, you know, lies over all the North Koreans. So how do you get the keys away from the jailers when they're afraid they're going to die the minute the cells are opened?
And that's the
conundrum.
This is why I said this is one of the most amazing diplomatic initiatives. And here you're not going to hear this in the mainstream media. Well, Bush administration is the one who really picked this up. And here it came in hard line. It picked up a couple of things that the Clinton administration had tried but dropped. The Clinton administration didn't keep the stick. There are carrots out there. Just for what it's worth, can go back and look. A piece I wrote in 1994, man, I got some tough letters about this. Austin Bay, you pro-defense conservative, you, how can you claim that the Clinton administration is doing the right thing by the heavy oil deal and potentially light the water reactors for North Korea? And my response to it was, sometimes when things are so crazy, you've got to put a little money in the middle of the table and see who reaches for it. The problem thing is, though, is that you don't just do carrots, you got to have sticks. Well, the Bush administration picks up and says, okay, they see exactly what Jim and I described. They see this paranoid regime. They see this situation that South Korea and China don't want an implosion. And that's bad for business, it's bad for everything. An explosion could also lead to another kind of explosion. So what you do is you're still trying to orchestrate the impossible. And it's not the art of the possible, it's orchestrating the impossible, which is, how do you keep it afloat enough so that there are none of these changes? And here's the end game. Here's the end game of that. And we don't know which faction will come to power. Jim's described it. The North Koreans don't know either after Kim Jong-il dies or whatever. There may be, and this is a very slender bet, there may be an opportunity for a different kind of relationship once the current Kim dies. You may see some of these quote-unquote progressive...
Well, the best hope I'm hearing is that the Chinese faction takes over.
Well, that's an opportunity? Yeah, of sorts.
Yeah, but the other option is that there's a palace, you know, a gun battle, as it were. There's a battle in Pyongyang, you know, where the factions fight it out, and of course that could get awfully nasty because they have that huge army. They have a million man army in a 22 million mm-hmm. population country. And that's what the Chinese and the South Koreans don't want. In fact, they've been doing some very discreet planning and coordination on what will they do if there is a collapse, just so there's no misunderstanding. You know, if the South Koreans rush in troops and relief supplies and what have you, and the Chinese, you know, that they don't start shooting at each other. That's something that hasn't gotten much media attention, and I probably shouldn't be talking about it either. But they're not stupid, and they realize that it was told to me in confidence, but hey. But they understand that it's a very delicate situation, but that may require some fairly stern measures, you know, if it gets out of hand. Because both China, and especially China, because the South Koreans have the DMZ with all those minefields to keep refugees out. The Chinese do not. They have basically an open, the Yalu River, and that's it. And they already have a problem with, you know, every year, every month, now these days, thousands of North Koreans are coming over and trying to blend in with the ethnic Korean population in northern China, which is fairly large. But they don't want millions of North Koreans coming across that border. They don't want to be in the position where they're going to have videos of Chinese border troops shooting, you know, starving North Koreans trying to get out.
Yeah.
It's just a potential, it's all downside for them. There's no upside.
Right, because China has the same issues that maybe not as much as South Korea, but their economy is not as strong as it was within the last decade. And in fact, they have an unemployment problem there. And so if all of a sudden they have millions of people streaming in, it's going to cause them some real problems.
Well, in northern China, they're not doing too bad. Yeah, most of the economy is, the big growth is in the south along the coast. But the real problems the Chinese have are in the interior.
Right.
The back country, as it were. The north is basically an economic problem. They have a large ethnic Korean, they always have had. You know, I don't know, it's 10-20 million, you know, Chinese citizens who are ethnically, you know, Koreans. But they understand that they can't hide a disaster like that because they've got, as they describe it, the damn internet. And all these people with their cell phone cameras and many of which can take videos and what have you. They know that crap's going to show, anything bad is going to show up on YouTube next. And they know they're going to have to pay for it. And you're right, they haven't got enough money. They cost them a mint to pay for the earthquake last year in central China. And they don't want another equivalent of an earthquake, you know, with North Korea collapsing and all those North Koreans coming over the border. And they're going to have the UN on their back. And China's trying to play, you know, international citizen now. They have peacekeepers in Africa, in Darfur. and they're trying to be the good guy, and they're going to be up against the wall in terms of doing the right thing if they do have this blow up in North Korea, and they get saddled with all these refugees. The Chinese do not want to have happen is all these foreign NGOs offering to come in. The Chinese will not let foreign NGOs come in, you know. So they're going to be on the spot to do all the good works themselves, which is expensive. And you're right, they'd rather spend their money on other things. The current economic recession is not hurting them as bad as you might think, because most people don't understand, well, the Chinese have a huge amount of business through exports. Exports are not the big part of their expanding economy. Their expanding economy is expanding internally. In other words, they're generating most of that growth simply from Chinese, you know, building things for other Chinese.
Right.
But
We're basically at the end. I guess what's going to happen here is that it sounds like everybody's just going to try to contain the problem and hope that not too many people starve to death.
Or not too many people, you know, just lose control and resort to violence. Whether it be the South Korean, the average South Korean, or the South Korean army, or the secret police, whether there's a coup, you're right. As Austin was saying, what the South Koreans have been trying to do is put enough resources in there just to keep things as they are for as long as possible, which is also absurd because eventually it's going to, you know, slide into a pit of utter depravity and disreputude. But they're trying to put off the day of judgment as long as possible.
I don't think they're going as they are. It's some sort of incremental improvement, springboard when the collapse comes. But, you know, that's also something we can...
everybody wants a soft collapse. They want a manageable collapse. They don't want utter chaos.
Well, that's a way to word it. I wanted to say one thing before...
Okay.
In this one, is that we do have an interesting moment coming up with if the North Koreans actually conduct this missile launch, and with the Japanese and now the United States saying we're going to intercept it if we decide to intercept it, and that'll be an interesting twist to the extortion racket. So that'll be in what, 3 weeks or so? I think that's when the
early April we're talking about.
Yeah, that's what, right. I think the last time I read is that we're going to try to launch between the 4th and the 8th of April. So.
Well, it'd be interesting to see a test of those systems.
Absolutely.
Yep. Well, we will talk to you next time, gentlemen. Have a great weekend, and